Right. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us online. My name is Timofey Brik. I'm assistant professor at Kyiv School of Economics, and I'm participating in this event from my apartment in Kyiv, where I have stayed during all these difficult weeks of this full-scale invasion. Together with our colleagues, we organized a series of lectures called Global Minds for Ukraine, inviting influential international intellectuals, artists, diplomats, scholars to talk about most pressing affairs, issues, and to discuss how can we, how can we understand what is happening now and what should we do to comprehend these events and what kind of ideas we can debate to maybe even to make some changes for better. And today we have an amazing speaker. We are very honored and very proud to have him, Professor Norman Neimark. He is a professor of European studies and also a senior fellow at Stanford and the Hoover Institution. He is we have many speakers who usually are introduced by saying they don't need introduction. I think Professor Neimark definitely is quite famous in Ukraine for his studies of Eastern Europe and genocide and Stalinism and our region. He is also a very active in scientific community. He is on the editorial boards of so many scientific journals like the American Historical Review and the Journal of Modern European History. So we're just very humbled and honored to have him, and especially because he's a leading expert in the topic of genocide studies and war crimes. And even though the topics itself are very dramatic and very difficult, we should take some intellectual courage to discuss these important issues today during the war. So thank you very much for being with us. I will let you speak to present your slides and then, or your lecture, and then I will help you to moderate the conversation with people who are watching us on Facebook and Zoom. So thank you very much, and please, you can take it from here.
Okay, thank you very much, Timofey. There won't be any slides. I'm very low tech. And have been and will be for the rest. I want to thank you very much for the invitation. It's really quite a wonderful thing for you and the university to be putting on, a lecture series devoted to the humanities in a period of inhumanity and war. So it's a real honor and a pleasure, and I'm humbled to be here with you. And of course, I, your colleagues at Stanford and other universities around the country and around the world, wish you the best, obviously, in your struggle, which in some senses is a common struggle. So my goal today is to talk about genocide, and I want to do so in sort of three, quick clips, if you will. I want to try not to take more than a half an hour or so, because I'm very interested in questions, obviously, and you're living in the middle of this question of genocide right now, so I'm curious to hear what you say. And first of all, I just want to say a few words related to my work on the world history of genocide, which continues. Second, I want to talk a little bit about the definitional issues having to do with genocide. And thirdly, inevitably, I want to talk about the atrocity crimes in Ukraine and how we think about, or at least how I think about, the issue of genocide in connection with Ukraine. So a couple of quick propositions that I just want to put out there about the history of genocide that I think is good context for mentioning its specificities. And the first is that genocide is embedded in human history. And by that I mean from the very beginning of human history, even in prehistory, there's evidence of genocide, although that's harder to proved, but certainly from the beginning of human history, you know, we have been faced with this phenomenon of genocide. And just imagine for a second, you know, going back even to the Old Testament, and we know that this was written by, you know, rabbis in the 5th and 6th century BC, and is partly fictional, but nevertheless, the Old Testament is filled with genocidal episodes. I mean, we think, you know, of the driving out of various peoples from Canaan, you know, where Yahweh orders his people to attack and kill all of the people involved. So you start from that and you go on, you know, to the Greeks, to the famous Miletian dialogue, you know, where the Athenians justify the fact that they have to kill all the people of that island, of Melos. You go on to Rome and the destruction of Carthage, especially in the Third Punic War, and you just keep going through history. You know, you go into the medieval period, into, you know, Crusaders, Genghis Khan, you know, through what we've now called settler genocide, that is to say genocide associated with, you know, big empires that are settling new continents, and in the process, murder and eliminate peoples in their wake. And then, of course, moving into the modern period. And then you know, this history of genocide is one that is pervasive. It's everywhere. And, you know, we'll never actually know all of those genocides. Now, we have different periods, as I've mentioned, of genocide. You can talk about ancient genocide, sort of medieval genocide. You can also talk about something which I do in some of my work, a communist genocide. There's a particular kind of genocide, you know, that communist regimes carried out in the 20th century. And here I would include, by the way, the 1932-33 Holodomor, you know, the killer famine that Stalin used, you know, to try to break the back of the Ukrainian people in the beginning of the 1930s. You know, you can also talk about, obviously, the Great Leap Forward in China in 58, 59, 60, about Pol Pot in Cambodia in the mid-70s. And these all have similar kinds of characteristics. But if you talk about this whole, you know, this whole panoply, historical panoply of genocide, you'll see that they have common characteristics. You know, you can go back, as I said, you know, to the Greek period or the Roman period, and you find things that are very similar, you know, to what goes on in the 20th century. Another thing that's important to say is that genocide can and should be historicized. And by that, I mean, these are not separate, you know, distinct episodes that sort of come and then disappear. They're linked with one another. People read and understand, you know, the history of genocide as they go along. So, for example, you know, the biblical episodes of genocide that I mentioned, you know, are frequently mentioned, you know, by the Spanish conquistadors in the New World as they're eliminating Indians there. So they're rehearsing, in other words, what happens before. I mean, the Roman destruction of Carthage is brought up by many genocidaires. You know, the Crusaders, you know, bring up stuff from biblical examples as well. Hitler, we know, you know, said, and who remembers the Armenians now, right? In other words, basically saying to his troops before the invasion of Poland in 1939, look, you know, they killed all those Armenians and who cares? So there's a kind of, you know, that people read, understand, absorb the lessons of genocide. Sometimes they absorb them in kind of perverse ways, as we're seeing with Vladimir Putin today, who talks about Nazis right in Ukraine. And he supposedly is using that, right, as a lesson for what he's doing in Ukraine. But of course, the reverse is true. You know, he himself has been engaging in what could be considered genocidal activity in Ukraine. So this is the point of trying to to historicize. Now, just again, to conclude this very brief exercise in talking about genocide in general, it occurs everywhere. You'll never know all of them. In other words, I teach a seminar on genocide at Stanford, and students are always coming up with new episodes of genocide, which I have never heard of. I am an editor of a new 3-volume, it's coming, we hope, this year, maybe next year, 3-volume Cambridge World History of Genocide. In that, there were genocides also that I had not come into contact with before at all. And genocide is just deeper and more pervasive, I think, than people really understand. You know, I mean, the Holocaust obviously absorbs a huge amount of attention when it comes to genocide, and it should absorb a lot of attention. But the point of fact is, it's an extremely widespread phenomenon. Okay, let me turn quickly now to definitional issues. And as I was reviewing this section, I realized, you know, that there are a lot of connections between Ukraine and this issue of genocide in terms of its of definitional content. First of all, it was precisely, you know, at the time at the end of August 1941, when Churchill made his famous statement, you know, we're in the presence of an evil, of a crime without a name. Right, without a name. So this is the end of August 1941, when the Nazis were marching into Ukraine, and in Kamenets-Podilsky, there was a huge massacre roughly at the same time that Churchill made his statement, and only a month later, as we know, there was this terrible massacre in Babyn Yar in Kyiv. So, you know, almost at the beginning of this, trying to find a definition for genocide, you know, Ukraine was there. And then, of course, and I'm probably not telling most of the people in the audience anything new, the author of the genocide convention, Raphael Lemkin, a Polish Jew who was born in Lithuania but was educated in Lviv at Jan Kazimierz University at the time, and knew a lot about Ukraine. Lemkin himself defined genocide after emigrating to the United States in a book in 1944 for the first time. I mean, he'd been working for a decade really on the definition. But he defines it in this book called The Axis Occupation of Europe. You know, genocide, and I'm going to read, term derived from the Greek genos or genos, tribe, a race, and the Latin side, by way of analogy, see homicide or fratricide. In other words, genos, you know, a people, and side, murdering. So killing a people, murdering a people. That's what he initially defined genocide as. And by the way, to you know, Lemkin was one of the first to recognize the Holodomor as genocide and to call Holodomor genocide, which he did in a speech on the 20th anniversary of the Holodomor in 1953 in New York. So they're very close ties then between the history of Ukraine and this concept of genocide. Lemkin had a lot of influence on the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide of 1948, which is what we look at carefully as the kind of fundamental statement for historians, social scientists, international jurists about genocide. Now, you know, not every part of it people like, not every part of it people still adhere to. The courts have evolved over the years and have added things here and there to the statement, but it's a little bit like the American Constitution. You know, it's the basic way we think about genocide. So let me do this very quickly and just do a little reading from the Genocide Convention, because I think that would be useful. Genocide are acts. Okay, this is, you know, the basic statement, and it's the most important. acts committed with intent to destroy, and again, underline that intent, because intent is an important part of the genocide definition. And when you think about genocide, the intent to destroy, not just destroying, but having the intent to do it, in whole or in part, again, you don't have to destroy an entire people, entire nation, but in part or in whole, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, comma, as such, period. Okay, that's really important, that comma, as such, period, because what that means is the intent is to destroy the ability of the group to function as a group, right? It's not just, and when I say just, I mean, terrible things are massacres and killings and all this kind of thing, but it's more than that. In some senses, you're trying to undermine the ability of the group to continue to function as a group altogether. And that's what the core of genocide is. There are a series of acts that are mentioned, and I'm going to do this very quickly. And almost all of these acts, by the way, have taken place in Ukraine, right? Killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the conditions of the group of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. I mean, we've seen evidence of a lot of that kind of behavior, right, on the part of the Russians in Ukraine. But the crucial part of the definition is the intent to destroy the group as such and its ability to function as a group. So that's, you know, that's the crucial thing here about the definition. I mean, the only thing I will add, and let me do this very briefly, is that there are four fundamental international crimes recognized by the International Criminal Court. Right? The International Criminal Court was set up by the Treaty of Rome, 1998, started functioning in 2003. And basically today is in charge, if you will, of the way the world deals with the crime, the atrocity crimes. And there are four of them, okay? One are war crimes. And, you know, here it's easy to say, I think, that the Russians have committed war crimes in Ukraine, right? The willful killing, torture, willful infliction of suffering. I mean, that's a war crime, right? Extensive destruction of property. Those are all war crimes. We've seen it in front of us. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing more to say about it except that it's happening in Ukraine. The second is crimes against humanity. And these crimes are also occurring in Ukraine. Again, some of them, let me just list a few of them: murder, extermination, enslavement, forced deportation. I mean, we've got some of that, you know, coming out of in Mariupol, rape, sexual slavery, and so on. These are all, you know, crimes that we've seen evidence of in Ukraine. So there's not, you know, there's no question in anybody's mind, or should be, that this is what's going on. The third major crime is war of aggression. Now here too, you know, it's clear to you and to me and almost everybody that the Russians undertook a war of aggression. The problem is, in the ICC, the International Criminal Court, war of aggression was added rather late to their brief. And when it was added, it was said that no party who had not signed on to be a member of the International Criminal Court could be accused of a war of aggression by the court, right? And Russia did not sign on. By the way, the United States did not sign on either. So that means the court cannot deal with this. Now, it doesn't mean a separate court can't. I mean, after all, what happened, I mean, everybody should be aware that 1946, the Nuremberg trials tried the Nazis and hanged leading Nazis primarily for a war of aggression, not for genocide, not for killing of Jews or anything like that. They hanged them because they started an illicit war. And that's exactly, you know, what the Russians have done in Ukraine. But the problem is the ICC has no jurisdiction over that. And then the fourth crime is the crime of genocide. Now, some people think, got helicopters flying overhead, I hope you can't hear them, but anyway, I lost my train of thought, but I'll get it back.
It was about genocide and that some people don't think about it properly or something like that.
Right. Well, okay. So genocide is considered by many people. It's not in the legal definitions, the crime of crimes. And therefore people want, a genocide conviction to be there. But in point of fact, in international law, these are really equal crimes and the punishments are really equal. So it's not bad to say, that what's happening in Ukraine is war crimes and crimes of humanity. And we don't know yet about genocide, but we'll talk about that in a second. In other words, there's no hierarchy in these crimes, except sometimes in people's minds, right? And sometimes legal experts actually will argue about it. I mean, I've read enough of these articles, is genocide the crime of crimes or not? And there's no real resolution to that. Okay, so what about genocide in Ukraine? Let's go over this very quickly. And there are really two parts to it, it seems to me. The first part is the, if you will, the ideological preparation for the committing of genocide, which it seems to me Russians have done. And this is a really scary and unfortunate part of what's gone on in Ukraine. In other words, it's not just a war of aggression, although it's that too, but what has happened is that in this war, the Russians have developed an entire ideological mind framework, for committing crimes. And that framework is based, as you know, I'm sure, on a whole series of articles, historical articles as well by Putin last July, in which he basically says, July 19, 21, right? On the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians. And that, that article, that's last summer, right? That article says, that Ukrainians are not a distinct nation, don't deserve to, have a distinct national presence, and therefore can be the object of Russian domination without any, historical legitimacy of its own. And that sets the framework for then many of Putin's statements, and also Medvedev and Lavrov and others, basically saying, what is this Ukraine? It's nothing. It doesn't belong there. And it doesn't have its own national existence. Well, that, of course, in some senses is genocidal itself. Even worse are some of the statements that are coming out of, associated Kremlin people. There was this thing by this journalist on April 3rd, Sergeyev in Novosti, which is a semi-official site, where he then spreads this idea that, initially the idea, I should take a step back, part of the idea of this, of course, is denazification, calling Ukrainians Nazis, this neo-Nazi stuff. And it would be just silly if it weren't so dangerous, And what it does is it takes, it diminishes Ukrainians, it engages in dehumanization, which is one of the characteristics of almost all genocides, and it paints Ukrainians into a corner where, which is first of all absurd, but second of all, as I said, very dangerous, because it makes them into something they're not. It turns them into certain kinds of animals, which they're not, and makes it possible then for Russian soldiers and the Russian public to actually believe that they're fighting you know, against these evil monsters, you know, a diminished evil monster, a kind of, you know, salamanders of sorts, you know, who are these Nazis. And what Sergeitsev does, what I was getting to, is he spreads this not just from the leadership, but to the population as a whole. And he, you know, he talks about kind of Ukro-Nazism, you know, and Ukro-Nazism is basically Ukrainian-wide Nazism. So you have a nation that doesn't deserve to exist, which are basically Nazis or neo-Nazis, and it leads to the kind of eliminationist possibilities that make for an extremely dangerous situation. I mean, we have mentioned one more, which I read. You know, this terrible woman, Margarita Simonyan, you know, who has written a series of things about Ukrainians. I'm just going to read you one very briefly, where she says, you know, she talks about Ukrainians and as Nazis. Says what makes you a Nazi is your bestial nature, your bestial hatred, and your bestial willingness. And again, beast, beast, beast. Remember the kind of animal you know, metaphors or analogies that are used in almost every genocidal situation. Willingness to tear out the eyes of children on the basis of nationality. That's end of quote. So you have Ukrainians who are tearing out the eyes of children, right, in this propaganda. And the propaganda seems to be, I mean, we don't know exactly, bought and absorbed, you know, by large numbers of Russians and Russian soldiers. And that, you know, that one shell, remember, that landed in Kramatorsk at the train station with Zadeti. And the whole idea is, you know, we're saving the children from the Ukrainians, you know, a kind of madness, right? A kind of madness that you see in genocidal situations, whether it's the Armenians, whether it's the Jews, whether it's Native Americans, you know, this kind of diminishing then of the enemy. Then there's the reality on the ground. I'm not going to rehearse a lot of that. You know it, you know, our audience knows it, the murder, the torture, the bodies lying around in Bucha, you know, the hands behind the back, the rape, you know, which is now being increasingly reported, which, by the way, the Bosnian courts upgraded as a part of genocide, you know, in other words, that systematic rape is now part of genocide. Filtration camps, relocation of children, all, you know, forced deportation, all these kinds of things belong, you know, to the complex of genocide and are very scary. So the war's not over, alas, right? Unfortunately, and there's still much that we need to know. Evidence is being collected. It's being collected by lots of different people. And I think, you know, I think it's wonderful that that's going on and that people are understanding from the very beginning that they have to collect evidence, they have to identify, they have to have film, they have to be very careful. We have 10 perpetrators now who've been identified, as you know, but we still don't know a lot about the main perpetrators who are sitting in the Kremlin, especially on this question of intent that I talked about earlier. We have to know what they want to do exactly. And we're not sure about that. This process is going to take a long time and people just have to be patient with it. You know, it took 15 years after Srebrenica for Slobodan Milosevic to be brought to trial in The Hague for his crimes. And as you probably remember, he died before the end of that trial. He would have been sentenced for genocide. The remaining Khmer Rouge leaders, you know, Pol Pot was long since dead. Most of them were in their 80s and 90s, were brought to trial only in 1997, 20 years after they killed about one-fifth of their nation, right? Including, you know, many, many Vietnamese and Han people, Buddhists, others. So, you know, like the war itself, which is going to take a lot of patience and fortitude on the, and it's having it on the part of Ukrainians. This genocide question is also justice, bringing justice, you know, the perpetrators is going to take a very long time. You know, no matter when the war ends, it's going to take a long time. Even if it ended tomorrow, it would take a very long time. The final thing I want to say, and I was alerted to this in another conversation the other day, again, is that the Genocide Convention is formally, again, called the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And prevention is an important part of this. And we are in a situation, a genocidal situation, in which prevention of further genocide is extremely important. You know, if genocide's already taken place, I'm not going to judge that because we don't have the evidence. But prevention is, you know, first and foremost right now. And I think it's a really good idea. I mean, someone said to me, well, why did Biden, you know, mention genocide, or why did Zelensky mention genocide? I think it's great that they did, because what this does is make us aware and make the Kremlin aware that people are watching and that people care and that evidence is being collected. And all of these things, I think, all of the attention that we can give to the genocide question, it seems to me, is essential in this period in order to prevent it. Obviously, winning the war would, you know, if the Ukrainians win the war, when they win the war, you know, that's the crucial, you know, that will stop, obviously, genocide on the part of the Russians. But attention to the problem is extremely important. A final word, and I conclude, and that is that war, you know, war and genocide are like, you know, a left hand and the right hand clapping. I mean, they're together. I mean, genocide almost always, not always, but almost always happens in wartime or during a period, at least when war is threatened. So bringing the war to an end would help a lot in preventing genocide. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this, you know, very informative lecture. I was quite shocked to hear that, you know, your team was able to compile this three volume piece about genocides, that I was quite poorly educated about this, you know, historical issue. And I could not imagine that we can have that book, such a huge book about the history of genocide. It's impressive and terrible, of course. We have some questions in the chat, but let me just start, you know, with my own question. I will take an advantage of being the moderator. So I'm quite surprised and shocked that the Russian society itself has tolerated this idea of genocide committed towards Ukrainians. Of course, they don't frame it as genocide. They find other ways to frame it, even though it's, you know, quite difficult to do. And given the whole history of this society and, you know, the build up, how their perception of the world and history really depends on the victory during the Second World War, and they portrayed themselves as the winners against, you know, the country, the Nazism, which committed Holocaust. And now this surprising flip, basically to commit new acts of genocide and finding ways to frame it in some, to frame it otherwise. And there are different scholars, you know, who try to explain it. Some people try to use communication science and explain it in terms of propaganda. Other people try to explain it in terms of social psychology. But maybe you can say something from your perspective, from the perspective of a historian. You know, I'm sure you know a lot about this long-term narrative changes in the Russian society and how they perceived Nazism, how they perceive their own state, how they perceive this current war in Ukraine. Can you somehow speculate on this unexpected shift in the narratives?
Well, it's you know, it's a great question, and I like the way you frame the part speculate, because that's, you know, all I can do. And I think that the explanations are very complicated, and there's no monocausal explanation. I mean, there are a series of explanations, and let's start, you know, with a proposition which I know to be a fact, that many, many, many Russians don't believe any of this garbage, right? I mean, that we know roughly 250,000 have left, and more probably going, because they can't stand it, right? I mean, they're also probably afraid a little bit about what's happening. And there are probably, you know, millions more who don't buy this utter nonsense that somehow Ukrainians are these Nazi murderers, right? And blood dripping Nazi murderers. So that let's establish that, right? That it's not necessarily in Russian DNA, you know, that they're going to believe this kind of propagandistic garbage. With that said, you know, there are things in, let's not call it DNA, but, you know, to those who talk about Russian social psychology, that are very deeply embedded. One of the things, you know, is just a lack of experience with open media and with doubting the propaganda that come, or the statements that come from the Kremlin. So, you know, I mean, I remember the bad old days, maybe now looking like good old days, you know, talking to colleagues in Russia who insisted that Marxism-Leninism was the only way, you know, to approach history. And how can I be a bourgeois, you know, historian, you know, and that kind of thing, you know, a kind of belief in the idea, in an ideology, you know, that is proffered, you know, by the central authorities. Again, it comes from the central authorities, and that there is a center, that there is this all-powerful state that then tells you, you know, what to believe and how to frame, you know, your lives. It runs very deep. And it goes back a long way, you know, into the Tsarist period too, where, you know, the Tsars were seen not just as rulers, but as, you know, oracles in some ways of what people, you know, ought to think about the world. So I think there's something there in the social psychology. And let's take an example, let's take an example of the Russian church. Right here, you have an institution that from the time of Peter the Great, you know, is completely subservient, you know, to the Russian state. I mean, Peter sort of breaks their back, right? Puts them in the Russian state, and then controls, as do the Soviets, you know, the nature of the church and what the church says. And then the church then parrots what the state wants it to say. And then the people who are believers believe what the church and the state are saying. So I think that, you know, that this is deeper than, you know, you mentioned communication science and propaganda and this kind of thing, all of which is also important. It's also important. But there's something about, you know, this history, the deep history of the Russian polity and its relationship to its people, you know, and that I think has a big influence here. So let me just put it that way. And the other things are important too, the politics, the modernity. I mean, you know, the fact that, I mean, I'm struck by, I mean, let me just say this very quickly. We can go into it more if you want. I think the Russian state's changing and evolving. Putin is changing and evolving during the war. I mean, it's getting much, much worse in my view. I mean, I don't think he was any angel before, but things are getting much worse. And Russia is moving, I think, in a direction of fascism. But one of the things you notice is the way he speaks into the, you know, and if you know Russian, it's quite shaking, I'm sure for you too. He speaks right into this computer, right? Just like it's me and I'm dominating your screen and I'm saying to you right up close, right? I mean, he gets really close to the camera, right? And he's speaking right into the people, and he speaks you know, you have to give it to him. He can speak well, and he speaks clearly, and he speaks forcefully and with conviction, right? And so it's like, you know, in the old days, it was Mussolini up on a podium or Hitler up on a podium screaming at masses of people. Well, Putin does this too, you know, as he did, you know, several weeks ago at a big rally. But when he gets in your face like that and he's telling you what to believe, you know, and you're a Russian, a simple Russian, you know, watching the TV, you believe it. And I think that's it's a power, this new medium, in other words, has become very, very powerful, I think, for spreading this kind of propaganda. So it's a little bit of traditional Russian ways of looking at leadership and the message from the Kremlin, plus, you know, new kinds of communications and communications possibilities.
Yeah, and you mentioned something very interesting, which catch my ear. You said that the Russia is moving towards fascism. And I heard, you know, from some other people and some other scholars that Russia, the Russian regime has been fascist for a while. So I wonder, you know, similarly to the topic of genocide, we have some definitional issues. Yeah, when should we call something genocide is a question, and also when should we call something fascism is a question. Can you just shed some light on it here? Why do you think Russia is moving? Why do you think Russia is not there yet? What should happen to make it more, you know, clear?
So, you know, like any phenomenon, you know, whether it's democracy or fascism or totalitarianism or authoritarianism or another, you know, there's a kind of spectrum of characteristics that you can identify, and you can identify. I mean, you can go back in history and say in Putin's history, and say those characteristics are already there. But you remember, in the early days, we used to call it, well, what they used to call it, managed democracy, right? I mean, there was less democracy and more managed, right, from the top. But I wouldn't have called the early years of Putin fascist. I mean, the middle years are more like good old-fashioned dictatorship, right? Where, you know, you see someone who controls everything. But I mean, you know, I lived and worked in Moscow in a lot of this period in archives and, you know, doing historical work. And it was, a pretty vibrant society. People could say what they wanted on the streets. You could opinion was free. You could still get, you know, a newspaper or watch some TV that had some critical stuff in it. You know, that's all gone. That's all gone. And even something, take something like Memorial, you know, which existed, worked, you know, had exhibitions, people went, I know, lectures, you know, all kinds of stuff. This was, you know, and Memorial was closed up when? Last Christmas time. So what I'm saying is that this is a gradual move towards fascism. The mobilization of society that fascism usually indicates, you know, has not occurred, is beginning to occur. Right, the way it didn't before. There weren't huge rallies. There weren't big, you know, big things in Red Square with people waving, you know, Putin banners or, you know, Russian banners or something. That's now happening. You know, so I think the kinds of mobilization of society, the kinds of rhetoric on the part of the leadership. I mean, the rhetoric is becoming much more what I would call fascist. Right. The person, I mean, Putin is, the cult of leadership, which is part of fascism, is becoming much more notable. There's something called corporatism, you know, which is, we consider a characteristic of fascism. And that was there, you know, pretty much all along, but it's gotten more intense. I mean, now, you know, a head of a corporation can't say boo, right? They can't say boo, they're gone. I mean, some guy from a bank, I can't remember, Pincus or something, just deprived of his bank. You know, so the integration of corporations, banks with the state and with Putin have become almost complete. And so the war, in some ways, is an accelerator of a lot of those processes. You know, I won't say there were different ways that Russia might have gone without the war, but the war has taken these processes that have brought fascism into, you know, into our vocabulary about Russia. I mean, it's not communism, we know that. It's not Marxism-Leninism, we know that. It's not managed democracy anymore, we know that. But it's not a simple dictatorship anymore either, we know that. And that evolution, I would argue, you know, the war has exacerbated in serious ways.
Yeah, I think I would agree with these observations completely. And I want to turn to the questions from the audience. There are several comments, and there was one question. I think you have already addressed it, but I think it's a very important still definitional issue, and I guess it's important for our audience, so they're asking these questions again and again. It's about a proven intent. Yeah. So the question is it genocide to actually destroy a group without a proven intent to do so?
That's a really interesting question. That's a really interesting question, and I'm not 100% sure how to answer that. I think it is not, by the legal definition, because you have to, it's a little bit like, you know, the analogy I like to use is murder, right? In US law, we have, you know, first degree, second degree, and third degree murder, manslaughter, right? First degree murder, you have to intend to kill somebody. Second degree murder, you kill them. And they're two different crimes. Right? Unless you can prove that you intended to kill that person, that you plotted, you got your gun, you knew who it was, and you went to get him, you had a reason for doing it. Although motivation is not part of genocide, it's much more intent, not motive, right? And so I think not. And, you know, a massacre. I mean, it's a very interesting and complicated issue, but Srebrenica, you know, again, this was what, 7,000-8,000 Muslim men and boys who were taken out and killed by the Bosnian Serbs. You know, that was deemed in a huge, I mean, you can read the legal stuff, and it's very complicated, you know, was deemed genocide because it was seen as an attempt, you know, to destroy the group of Bosnian Muslims. You know, people will contest that. Just to take out and massacre 7,000 people is not genocide unless you are intending to destroy the group and make the group not functional.
Yeah, so I wonder if we go back to your...
Can I say one more thing about intent?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay. So the other thing I wanted to say about intent, which is very interesting and came out of the courts in Bosnia, was that, and again, the Srebrenica massacre was important in this connection, is that you don't have to show, in other words, you don't have to show that the leadership, Milosevic in this case, said, I'm going to kill those guys in Srebrenica in order for him to be indicted for genocide. But if the actual actions reveal intent, and in this case, you know, trucks are sent to move the people to a place where they can be shot, graves are, you know, mass graves are buried, are dug for people to be buried in, you know, so in other words, intent, Putin doesn't have to say, I'm going to, you know, kill Ukrainians and I'm going to murder them and destroy them as a nation. But what you do have to do is have evidence that shows that that in the actual carrying out of these murders, he's intending, you know, to destroy the Ukrainians as a nation.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. I assume that if we take your book, the three-volume book about genocide, probably given the fact that you're talking about deep history of so many societies, you rarely know the actual motivation and of these people. They never confessed. Yeah, you just infer the intent from the observed actions and logistics and things like that. Yeah, so there are some other questions. There are actually several questions, but they all address the same issue. Okay. So the issue which bugs our audience is the both criminal and moral responsibility of wider masses of people. Yeah, so we can talk about Putin, we can talk about Russian army, but people are also interested, you know, in general about Russian society and different groups in this society. Can you actually attribute some blame, criminal, to people who, you know, who let genocide happen, maybe by indifference or by, you know, passively participating? But I think I sense from the questions that our audience is interested in both, you know, criminal and also moral issue and judgments. So can you comment on both of these?
Okay. All right. Again, you know, it's an interesting and important distinction. I mean, the criminal is, I won't say it's easy, you know, but there is, again, a huge body of law, you know, which deals with the criminal issues. And, you know, they're constantly being updated and, you know, lawyers are constantly writing new articles and law journals about it. But I think, you know, the criminal part is pretty straightforward when it comes to essentially, you know, the bystanders in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, you know, who would like to stop the war but can't, or those who say, good, there's a war, you know, and Ukrainians are Nazis. I mean, in some ways, they're both, you know, they're both culpable, but it, you know, on one level, as bystanders, but not criminally, right? Not criminally. Maybe as a society, we can talk about, you know, the collective responsibility of the Russians for what's going on. And I think we will talk about collective responsibility. You know, the moral question is a different question and a hard question. And it's a hard question for individuals, I think. And I think a lot of Russians, you know, who are on the right side of this conflict, you know, are torn apart by it. I mean, I can tell you, and I'm sure you have friends and people in the audience have friends who are really, really torn by this war in terrible ways and wish there was something they could do about it. But can't find a way. So the moral responsibility of people for genocide, you know, I think is something which we will, you know, philosophers and others will talk about, and you know, will, and ethicists, you know, I'm kind of less willing to pronounce on that. I mean, I don't feel like I have that kind of, you know, who am I talking about exactly? And what situation are they in exactly? You would need to know in order to be able to say. I find it difficult, again, to, you know, I think that there's certainly collective responsibility on the part of Russian society for what's going on. There's no question about it. But are they morally culpable? You know, all of them? I don't know. I mean, the soldier who goes to Bucha and shoots somebody because he thinks they're a Nazi, you know, is criminally culpable and morally culpable, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there's no excuse, you know, for engaging in any atrocity whatsoever. I mean, you feel a little bit, remember they had those, what, 10 soldiers or so that they interviewed, or maybe Ukrainians interviewed, you know, from, you know, they're from various boondocks in Russia, Siberia, and, you know, these young kids saying, I don't, you know, here I am, what the hell am I doing here? I didn't even know, you know, where I was going, and you know, nobody's bothered me. Why am I bothering them? you know, the for those young men, you know, I feel very badly. But of course, on the other side, a lot of them are doing, you know, really terrible things. So each case is going to have to be a little bit different. I'm babbling a little bit because I think I don't have a real strong kind of point of view about this.
Oh, as you said, you know, this thing will be discussed by many people, and philosophers and lawyers, and of course, it's serious moral issues. We have only a few minutes left. I will ask the final question. So, as you mentioned in your lecture, that a lot of people treat genocide as a crime of crimes, even though from the legal perspective it's not true. Yeah, there is no hierarchy, but that's what people have in their minds. And I also think that, well, when people think about genocide, a lot of people draw from the history of Holocaust. Yeah, so people think that Holocaust is a genocide of genocides. Yeah, so that's why they also draw from the history of Germany, and you know how Germany changed and completely in their attitudes towards the history of the Second World War. Do you believe that, you know, in foreseen future, Russia can change, and what should be done? Should we aim for the regime change, educational change, better textbooks, changes of culture, of human nature? What should we hope for?
Oh boy, that's a great question. And you know, I you know, historians will often just say, well, you know, I study the past, I know what happened then because it happened, right? What's going to happen in the future?
Well, data scientists, so they say the same.
You know, there are a couple of things to say. First of all, remember, it took the Germans a long time. It took the Germans a long time. No one should imagine this was easy, and that somehow, you know, a page was flipped easily, you know, from one sense of who they were and what they were doing to another. It took a long time, and it's still going on. I mean, there's still a process, you know, of trying to convince people. As we know, there's a revival on the right, and you know, people are saying Nazis weren't so bad and stuff like that. So I mean, I'm a big fan of Germany. I go there a lot, but one shouldn't imagine that somehow, you know, black turned to white. There are still a lot of issues in Germany, although there's a concerted effort, a really concerted effort on the part of society and, you know, the government, you know, to make sure that, you know, people understand what they did. And they became such pacifists, you know, that this recent kind of flip to helping Ukraine was such an enormous thing. I was in Berlin at that time, and it was really a huge change in attitude, you know, public attitude towards supplying arms and trying to help Ukrainians. You know, whether that stays or not, we'll see. Now, the Russians, it's a really hard question. I mean, I can remember in the 1990s talking to some Russian friends who said the only way this is going to change is if you occupy us, you know, the way Germany was occupied after the Second World War. You know, would the Germans have changed that radically if they hadn't been occupied and the occupiers didn't, you know, really rub their noses into the past in a way, you know, that forced them in some senses to change? You know, I don't really know. I mean, I'm one of those people who believes in the good forces in nations, you know, whether it's Germans or Ukrainians or Americans or Russians. And there are good forces in that society, and they're positive ones. And I had hopes, you know, in the 90s that, you know, that there would be a real reckoning with the Stalinist past. Let's not talk about this past. And, you know, a reckoning came of sorts, you know, it started. But again, you know, it would have taken a long time. It would have had to gone very deep. And now Putin has basically kind of cut that off completely. But that kind of reckoning with the Stalinist past, you know, was already extremely difficult and relatively shallow in parts of society, so that you still have this kind of majority of people in Russia who believe that Stalin was a very positive figure. So in this case, I mean, it's not, let's put it this way, Timothy, it's not impossible, you know, it's not impossible that there could be some kind of democratic revolution of sorts, a democratic upheaval in Russia that will bring the kinds of people to power, you know, that will be ready to deal, you know, with what's happened in this period now and in the Stalinist period, and will say to themselves and to the Russian people, listen, we've got to come clean about what happened in the past, otherwise we'll never have a clean future. And that's, you know, that's really the essence of it. And you know, and this process goes on again in other countries in different ways. It goes on in the United States too, you know, with slavery and with what happened to American Indians. You know, you've got to have that process, and it is a process. And hopefully, you know, knock on wood, one fine day, that will happen in Russia too. But right in the immediate future, I that's very unlikely. And even in the intermediate future, I don't think I'll see it. And the sad part of it is, let me just conclude this question. The sad part of it is, you know, I've got a lot of Russian friends, you know, and colleagues, you know, who had, and I think about them all the time, you know, who had hoped, you know, that the bad old days were gone. You know, Stalinism, Soviet Union, that's all gone. And now we can experience something like, you know, liberalism and freedom and travel and this kind of thing, joining with the rest of the world. And now they are my age and they see, you know, it's not going to happen in their lifetime. That's sadness, really, for a generation that was born after or maybe during the Second World War.
Yeah, well, thank you for your profound thoughts. And it's very interesting to see, you know, that maybe it's a feature of a historian of war crimes and genocide to talk about sad things with a smile. So what can you do? Exactly. Yeah. And thank you for spending this hour with us. I just want to plug in one thing that we always plug in our lectures. So yeah, we're talking about dramatic events, we're talking about the war and massacres, but we also try to save lives. And our university has fundraised already more than $22 million to purchase and to deliver medical kits. We're still fundraising, and I put the link to our chat. So if you're interested to support us, please follow this link. It's very easy to do. We have a charitable foundation registered in the US, so it's tax exempt and everything, and you can donate in euro, dollars, crypto, whatever. So help us to save lives. And Norman, thank you again, Professor Nymark, for your lecture, your wisdom, and your time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And, you know, good luck, man.
Thank you. We'll see you in peaceful Kyiv. Okay. Bye-bye.
Soon, hope.
Soon.